Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to EIR Talks. It's Thursday, November 15, 2001, and this is Tony Papert. Today's show will be devoted to a speech given by Lyndon LaRouche to an international conference, November 5th in Berlin, on what's to be done about the international financial economic crisis. But before that, I'd just like to talk a minute about how the official line on the September 11th attacks is being undermined around the world and some of the surprising consequences of that. Now, since Lyndon LaRouche on a radio talk show, as the September 11th attacks were taking place, said that this was going to be blamed on Osama bin Laden, but that actually it was a coup attempt launched from within the United States, and our problem is here, not in Afghanistan. Since he said that, and he said it since, many influentials in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere have come to see that LaRouche was right or come to strongly suspect that he is right. And definitely few of them believe the story about Osama bin Laden. I mean, it's been clear from the start that he was not capable of conducting these kinds of massive precision military-like attacks. Now, most of the people, with few exceptions, those who agree with Lyndon LaRouche or who've seen that he may possibly be right, are not saying so openly, although some have. But in general, what they're doing is putting out facts, patterns, stories, which knock holes in the official Osama bin Laden foreign terrorist story. This has been most notable out of France, although it's also occurred from other countries. The first week in November, the leading French daily paper, Figaro, published a story which was made to seem as if it came out of top levels of French intelligence, which in fact it did, which said that in July of 2001, Osama bin Laden went to a hospital in Dubai and there was visited by the head of the consular section of the American consulate in Dubai, who communicated with him in his hospital bed. So this certainly casts doubt on the official story to the extent that if it were true, and it has some verisimilitude, it shows that the United States was in discussions with Osama bin Laden as recently as July. Now, around the same time, a rather small circulation French newsletter of a group called Réseau Voltaire, the Voltaire Network, which also is well known as an intelligence leak sheet also involving large sections of the French police apparatus, began to publish a extensive two-part story, which began from the fact that, according to Réseau Voltaire, and some of these facts we verified, others not, on the day of September 11th, the National Security Council, the president, the vice president, were talking about fearing a military-style coup and were not saying among themselves that they were under attack by terrorists. They saw it as a military coup type of operation, according to Réseau Voltaire, which adduces considerable facts in support of that and goes through a history of part of the rogue elements in the U.S. military, which have a coup capability against the U.S. government, and also their involvement in the Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination. Now, so these stories came out, others came out, and then to when the dam broke this past Tuesday, November 13th, when the most widely known Paris daily, Le Monde, published in turn their version of the story. Their version was different from the others. Their version attempted to show that the attack against the Taliban in Afghanistan, which the United States launched on October 7th, had actually been prepared as early as last summer. It was also identified, again, as being a leak from top levels of French intelligence. So with these stories having come out in this way, and with Le Monde, as I said, having broken the dam or being the straw that broke the camel's back, What immediately resulted was a government crisis in Germany. Germany, as we speak now, November 15th, Germany is in the midst of what is seemingly the biggest governmental crisis since the end of World War II. The immediate issue, although it's not the real issue, but the immediate issue is commitment of about 4,000 German troops to support the efforts of the so-called Coalition Against Terrorism. The troops, once committed, may be going to Afghanistan, they may be going elsewhere, that's not completely clear. But there is a government crisis in Germany immediately because of opposition to the troop deployment from within the governing coalition of Chancellor Schröder, both the Socialist Party, which is one part of that coalition, and more especially the Green or Environmentalist Party, where there's even more opposition. Now, the real basis for the government crisis is in part the September 11th events. In much larger part, it's the entire background of September 11th, which is an out-of-control financial depression crisis, as LaRouche is about to explain in his speech from Berlin, which governments are unable to control. So we not only have a government crisis in Germany, we have a government crisis right here in the United States. We have government crises not only in Argentina, we have government crises in Brazil and elsewhere in the Americas. We're in what's called a pre-revolutionary period, where the man in the street comes suddenly to realize that the official policy lines, the double talk from politicians and the press, are lies as they regard the September 11th attack, and they're lies as regards a great many other things. We're in a crisis of the governability of our countries. And the question for us at this moment is what we personally do with the crisis, what we make of it, how we resolve it, not how we understand it, but how we lead the frightened populations of our countries, frightened, of course, by terrorism, frightened also by the unrolling of their economies, mass layoffs, mass unemployment, how we lead them safely over the abyss formed by the present crisis, whether you consider it the war on terrorism, the economic crisis. They're actually part of the same thing, as LaRouche has explained. Now, having said that, let me go back to a topic which we've discussed in many of these shows over the past year, the closure of DC General Hospital as part of the general wiping out of public health infrastructure in the United States, especially under the managed care HMO system introduced into law by President Nixon. Now, in the midst of the fight to maintain healthcare infrastructure in the United States, in the midst of the fight to save DC General, which was betrayed by the Democratic congressional leadership, came the September 11th attacks, and the prospect of biological terrorism, as we've seen in the anthrax attacks, or biological terrorism on a larger scale. In this crisis, Congresswoman Maxine Waters of Los Angeles, Democrat of Los Angeles, became one of the few American politicians to openly say what a great many have, of course, privately said, which is that LaRouche was right and we were wrong. In a congressional briefing yesterday on the public health crisis led by Congressman Conyer and Congressman Kucinich, Congresswoman Maxine Waters said, "We've had people coming to us for months on the question of DC General. We ignored it because the movement was led by the LaRouche people. Now September 11th has come. They were right and we were wrong. We should all apologize, and I take this opportunity now to apologize." Those were not her exact words, but the drift of what she said. And with that, let's move to Berlin, Germany, November 5th, and a talk by Linda LaRouche.
In my incarnation as a management consultant, which occupied most of my activities of the 1950s and the first half of the 1960s, I was often told explicitly or implicitly by clients, "Don't blame me, blame my accountant." That is, the point is, the fellow would say that I had always gone by our accounting department's analysis and forecast of our company's future in guiding the way we invested in various ways, the way we allotted our resources to production and other things. So blame my accountant. Today we have the same kind of pathology of reliance upon accountants in the form of general public opinion and government opinion, which obviously does not function. And this is because the population, especially in the past 35 years, has more and more become economically insane. In the former period, we used to think, partly as accountants think, but also partly as human beings think. As accountants, we thought about the figures we invented and put into invented forms called accounting and financial reports. As human beings, we looked at the physical changes in the environment, and as economists, we looked at the changes in the conditions of production and distribution in physical terms. And therefore, we measured the physical performance of our accounting and financial systems. In the middle of the 1960s, the world underwent a change that, whereas in the period from 1945 through 1963, Western Europe and the Americas and Japan in particular had prospered under a system which was by no means perfect or by no means fully just, but nonetheless, there was a net growth in per capita physical product, in per capita standard of living, in per capita productivity, and the general productivity of industries. From about the time it coincides with the assassination of Erhard, the ouster of Adenauer, the first assassination attacks on de Gaulle, in this period, and the introduction of the terrible Harold Wilson government in England, the United Kingdom, we've seen a consistent decline, not only in the physical standard of production. Think, for example, in the case of Germany. Think of great industries. Take, for example, take AEG from the early 1960s. What is AEG today compared with what it was in the early 1960s? Think of famous firms which have disappeared, which were an integral part of what was called the German economic miracle of the post-war period. They have disappeared, or they're looted. Great firms, which were once proud firms and represented a high standard of technology and productivity and employment, now still exist, but they exist like the walking dead. They've lost their engineering capability through outsourcing and various other kinds of things, the introduction of benchmarking and other forms of insanity which have destroyed the economy. So over the period of the past 35 years, there have been a succession of changes in the way the world thinks about economy. And political parties and politicians and bankers and so forth have played a key part in this, in telling people to look at the figures, look at the financial figures. The reliance upon finance and accounting to the detriment of considering and comparing physical results has resulted in a condition as of today. In the United States, we have an insane man, and I say that advisedly. And as Americans, we're permitted to say things about Americans that Europeans are not supposed to say. But I can tell the truth about the United States as an American political figure. We are insane. We have a Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, who is not only abysmally immoral personally, but he's insane. We have an effort on the part of Greenspan and others to pump up the financial markets, the stock markets, and so forth, by the most wildly hyperinflationary method seen since Germany in 1923. The businesses are collapsing, employment is collapsing, firms are being liquidated, and yet they don't pay any attention to that in the press reports or the propaganda. They talk about, oh, the market is coming back, while everything else is going. The physical economy is collapsing. Infrastructure, All kinds of things are collapsing. And there's not much attention paid to it in the policymaking circles, even in the case of the present Bush administration, which since the developments of last summer, not only the September 11th events, but the events of September 10th, the day before, was in a position where it began to change its policy to say that the government must intervene with a statist policy to revive the economy. Now, what the Bush administration has done will not work. Trying to get military producers to produce junk that doesn't function may keep those stockholders of those firms happy for a short period of time, but they're not producing any wealth. It's a swindle. Dumping hundreds of millions of dollars of bombs on a country which probably doesn't have hundreds of millions of dollars, as in Afghanistan, is not exactly the way to build a world economy. But nonetheless, there's a change, a recognition of a change. But the change reflects the fact that the present system doesn't work. Now, the problem today is that people are still blaming the accountants. Finance ministers, governments, and others are saying, we must have a reform. What kind of reform? We must have a reform in various programs. We must have a pension reform. We must have all kinds of reforms. But these are not, do not represent changes in the system. They don't represent any correction of the errors which have been built into the system over 35 years. Remember, we had a period from approximately 1945 to the middle of the 1960s in which the Bretton Woods system, which was a gold reserve-based, well-regulated system, protectionist system, caused those who participated in the system as nations to improve the standard of living, improve productivity, generally the perception of prosperity and future. From the change that occurred during the interval between 1964 and 1967, a trend of changes. We've gone downward. It went downward since 1971. The floating exchange system has bankrupted the world. We've gone through subsequent changes, but I'll indicate a few of them to you just to indicate how this thing goes. But we should recognize, therefore, the problem is not a problem of how to fix the present system, but how to replace it. We have more debt than can ever be paid under the present system. No one will ever get out of this system under the present financial system. Let's look at world history. Look what I mean by systemic approach in these terms. Modern post-war history, post-World War II history, can be divided into several overlapping periods. Chiefly, we have the period from 1945 to 1971, the period of the post-war Bretton Woods system, of a fixed exchange rate based on not a gold system, but a gold reserve system. It was a production system well designed to meet the immediate need of the post-war world for reconstruction of economies which have been shattered and depleted by depression and war. The focal point of this was, again, the credit of the United States in extending U.S. credit as backing to extension of long-term and medium-term credit to Europe for the reconstruction of Europe and similar kinds of programs in other parts of the world. This worked more or less well. The performance varied from nation to nation. Germany had a very successful venture in this direction. Germany was the most successful, the most efficient of all the countries participating in this system because the credit system and the industrial system was better. There was some attempt to imitate that in France under de Gaulle, but that was the situation. So we went from a period which covered the old Bretton Woods system, which was also a system based on a peculiar arrangement of nuclear war and détente between two nuclear superpower alliances, the Anglo-American and the Soviet. That part of the system continued until 1989-1991. But in the meantime, there's an overlapping change from a post-war Bretton Woods system based on a gold reserve standard to the floating exchange rate system, which has been the principal cause of the global disaster we suffer today. Then in 1989-91, there was another change. The Soviet power disappeared. At that point, an interest centered in London and New York City, a financier interest of a rentier quality, not a capitalist interest, but a rentier financier interest, which controlled the world largely through control of financial markets and the control of governments in the interest of financial markets. This system attempted to set up a world empire, an Anglo-American world empire modeled on the precedent of medieval Venice. Venice from about the fall of the Byzantine Empire, its first phase of fall, about 1,000 years ago, until the decline of Venice as a nation-state power at the end of the 18th century or 17th century. So in that period, Venice developed a system of control of most of European civilization and its periphery as a financier power, as an imperial maritime power, through financial manipulation of the affairs of the nations involved. Venice collapsed after a last effort at imperial revival in the end of the 17th century. But at that point, Venice and its methods were continued under the Dutch and British monarchy. That is identified specifically by William of Orange, the tyrant of London, and his successor, designated successor, George I and his followers in London. And George I was essentially an agent of the British East India Company, which was an extension of the policies of the Dutch India Company, of William of Orange. And so this interest, typified by Shelburne in the 18th century, controlled most of Europe through a certain kind of relationship to its Habsburg competitor in Spain and Austro-Hungary. Under these conditions, the United States emerged with the support and backing from Europe, as the attempt to create a modern nation state as an alternative to this system of relations between the Anglo-Dutch Venetian-style monarchies and the Habsburgs. We went through a process which continued until the victory of the United States in 1861-76, Lincoln's victory over the British and over the Confederacy immediately, the British puppet, which made a change in the world economy. You can see in the 1861-1877 period a change in the policies of Europe. Now, Europe never developed, except for one experiment by Charles de Gaulle in one phase of the Fifth Republic, never developed a true republican nation-state form of any durability. What existed in Europe were reforms of essentially a feudal system, a parliamentary system, of parliamentary governments which became somewhat democratized in the sense that the interest of the general welfare was a pressure upon the state apparatus of the regular state and also of governments. This was the improvement. But these improvements were adopted especially in Europe after the victory of the United States over the British as well as the Confederacy in 1861-1876. The emergence of the United States as a leading world in agro-industrial power over this period caused a change in 1877 in the economic policies of Germany under Bismarck, the famous industrial explosion in Germany. It caused changes in Russia, notably, in the policies of Mendeleev, who was at the 1876 American centennial celebration, and who, with the Tsar's agreement, launched the building of what became the Trans-Siberian Railroad and large industrial projects. And there were other things. Japan. Japan was reorganized by the United States through Henry C. Carey, who was then aging, the leading U.S. economist, an advisor of Lincoln. And the advice of Carey was crucial. He was in Germany in 1879, in the influence through those circles in Germany of introducing the Carey conception, or the Carey, as it's otherwise called, Friedrich List conception, into Germany. In case of Japan, Carey sent his personal student, E. Pechstein Smith, who was the advisor of Japan, who started the industrial transformation of Japan. So you had developing across Eurasia, as other parts of the world, the American system of political economy, typified by names such as Carey and Friedrich List, throughout much of Eurasia. That, with 1901, with the assassination of McKinley, that changed for the worst. The changes that already begun about 1892 in France and elsewhere with the, around the Dreyfus case and other things. But in 1901, the assassination of the last pro-patriotic president of a series, William McKinley, who was assassinated by assets of the Theodore Roosevelt family, caused Theodore Roosevelt to become president, and a fundamental change was made in U.S. policy and U.S. relation to Europe. Prior to that, under all patriotic presidents and patriotic currents in the United States, the chief foreign partners of the United States had been, since the time of the American Revolution, influences in Germany, especially the classical circles, influences in Russia, which had been part of the League of Armed Neutrality, and Japan had become also an asset of the United States against the British interest. And the United States was in opposition to the Anglo-Dutch interest internationally. This continued despite other changes until 1901, the assassination of McKinley, at which point the United States entered a new system of relations. It broke its attachment to Russia. It broke its attachment, that is the Russia of Witte, the Russia of Mendeleev. It broke its attachment to Germany and became an integral part of an international maritime alliance, the so-called transatlantic alliance, between the British monarchy and the United States, and with the Dutch monarchy added in as part of the pattern.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
So therefore, except for the Roosevelt period, the Franklin-Roosevelt period, from 1933 through 1945, at Dulles' assassination, except for that period, the United States has been a part of an Anglo-American world financier maritime imperial power. What happened, therefore, in 1989, at a point where I, in 88, had proposed here in Berlin the imminent collapse of the Soviet system and the imminent reunification of Germany and the imminent designation of Berlin to become again the capital of Germany, and had proposed a system of cooperation to take up the slack left by the bankruptcy of the Comecon system for a general Eurasian revival of economy based on new ideas of cooperation based around things like food, transportation, and so forth. That was not done. That was proposed by the last effective banker of Germany, Alfred Herrhausen, who had intended to make that proposal to a New York conference, which he planned to address but did not address because he was assassinated in the meantime. And since that time, there has been no policy generally in the United States of Europe in that direction. What happened was, in effect, under the initiative initially of the British and the support of Mitterrand, and with the consent of Bush, it was agreed under Bush's pressure, acting under pressure from the ambassador to Germany, of Vernon Walters. Vernon Walters said to Bush, in effect, don't be an idiot. Let Germany be reunified. Otherwise, you'll cause a crisis. So Germany was reunified with the consent of President Bush, despite the strong objections and hatred of Germany by Margaret Thatcher and by François Mitterrand. Right? But the conditions that were imposed upon not only Germany, but on relations of Germany with other countries, such as those of Eastern Europe and Russia, was such as to ensure not the great economic revival which could have occurred at that point, but instead a vast destruction of resources such that apart from the improvements in some of the public infrastructure, entertainment centers and housing and so forth, and more freedom in the eastern part of Germany, there has been no significant gain economically by the populations of the former Comecon sector to this date, but in general has been a ruinous state far worse than these people have experienced under the Soviet rule at the concluding phase. So we've entered a phase first, then in 1989-91, a phase of the Thatcher, Mitterrand, Bush dictated conditions upon continental Eurasia, terms dictated, in order to establish and consolidate an Anglo-American world empire of a form called globalization, the elimination of the nation state as an institution, and its replacement by global institutions controlled through financier syndicates, which would loot the world according to their pleasure. Now we've come to the point that that system, that post-1989 globalized system, as an aggravation of the disease called the floating exchange rate system, has now combined its effects to bring the entire world to a point of disaster. Now, obviously to us, the obvious first reaction must be, looking at this period as a whole, looking at the past three centuries or more of European Eurasian history, looking more narrowly at the picture of the 20th century disaster, the geopolitical disaster called World War I and its succession, World War II, another geopolitical disaster, orchestrated in the same way. We must say that in the more recent period, since 1945, what we had for the first 15 years following the close of war was a system, a fixed exchange rate system, which worked with all its shortcomings and errors and follies. We replaced that system in the middle of the 1960s, we replaced it with what became in 1971 the floating exchange rate system, which was based not on economic interest, not the economic interest of the nations, that is the physical economic interest of the nations, but rather on a financier interest, which said we come first and you get the leftovers that drop from the table, if there are any. This system underwent a series of changes, successive changes. First, the worst was under Carter, President Carter, deregulation, which caused more damage to the U.S. economy in 4 years than all presidencies since. Then we had globalization. In 1989-91, it began the process of globalization, which accelerated this process. We've now come to the point that the fixed floating exchange rate system, the globalized system, is finished. Any attempt to present a solution, remedies, improvements, reforms in the system, which does not go back to 1965 and earlier, to reverse most of the leading policy changes introduced by governments and international institutions in that period, would be a catastrophic mistake. It would ensure disaster. The key to this problem is twofold. First of all, we have a very simple problem. We have a bankruptcy of a financial system. The financial system is hopelessly bankrupt. There is no reform, no negotiation, which can keep the values, the present financial values outstanding, intact. There must be a consent of a general reduction of a very large percentile in most of what are considered financial assets today. Stock market values, financial claims, mortgage claims, so forth, simply forget them because they could never be paid under the present system. Is it not fraud to take credit from governments and others to try to continue a bankrupt investment in shareholder values which are not collectible? Is it not a fraud to pretend that Argentina can be bailed out by saving the present obligations, financial obligations imposed on Argentina? Is it not true in the other parts of the world? These are hopelessly bankrupt situations. You have to decide whether you're going to try to pretend to save the system, which you can't, because you cannot get milk by killing the cow. The cow must be fed. Otherwise, it doesn't produce milk. You kill the cow, no more milk from that cow. Therefore, you cannot kill the cows, call the nations that produce the milk on which these financial interests depend. Therefore, you're in a state where the financial system is bankrupt. Therefore, governments must declare the financial system bankrupt and use the sovereign authority of governments individually and as combinations of sovereign entities to reorganize the system in bankruptcy. It's what we did at the end of World War II. We reorganized the world in bankruptcy. And the United States had the power to do it, and therefore we did it. We now come to the point we have to do it again. But there's a second aspect to this. Apart from canceling the accounting system and starting a new one, based on the best precedents from the past. The second thing is we must understand the significance of the sovereign nation state. The greatest danger to Europe and other parts of the world now is the destruction of the sovereign nation state. The greatest danger to any economy. No economy can work in Eurasia unless it is based on a sovereign nation state as the sovereign authority over its national credit, over its banking system, and over its trade policies. Why? The function of the nation state has been twofold. The nation state, which was first founded in France and then later in England, in France under Louis XI and in England under Henry VII, was the first form of society which established modern society. A state which was absolutely sovereign and which was not controlled by some interest, such as a feudal interest or financier interest, but a state which was accountable to what was called the general welfare or common good of the entire people. Therefore, the state became a personality embodying the personality of the nation, and as a personality was responsible to the entirety of the population, to its past heritage, and to its future opportunities, to that people. It must serve the common good. It must promote the general welfare. This kind of state, which is sovereign, had the power to create credit, as Louis XI did in a limited way in France, to create credit, public credit against what? Not against existing money, not against existing physical assets, but against future assets yet to be created. Public credit. This public credit must be created with foresight into the general welfare. You cannot create credit without anticipating the production of wealth which will secure the credit issued as debt. Only the nation state can do that. For example, in the case of the United States Constitution, what we do under the Federal Reserve System is totally unconstitutional. The constitutional provision has never been repealed, and therefore the Federal Reserve System is an outlaw. It's illegal under constitutional law. The provision of the U.S. Constitution is that the only person, the only that can issue money is the President of the United States through the Treasury with the consent of Congress. That the issuance, the power to create money of the state becomes the basis for national banking. So state credit is used to provide the margin of increase over private credit resources to ensure a general growth for national purposes. Now, in the case now of Europe, of the United States, of Russia and elsewhere, there's no possibility that on the basis of the present flows of production that Europe could survive. Europe is now producing below break-even. If the infrastructure which is being used up were to be maintained, if the essential industries which are we implicitly depend upon today were allowed to be decay, were not maintained, if the maintenance of the general infrastructure were not expanded, there's no possibility that Germany, France, Italy, etc., could survive as economies. The money does not exist in the form of money capital to bring these economies out of this desperate, hopeless state. Only the nation state can create credit and apply that credit to such uses as large-scale needed infrastructure and to other special projects, to extension of credit on the long-term to medium trade to former customers or future customers such as China, India, Russia, and so forth, is the only hope for Western Europe. For example, Germany today, its only future lies in terms of trade of the trade relations which are improving with China and Russia. In every other part of the world, Germany is going down and losing its markets. This will increase. This is the condition of all of Europe, of Italy, of France, so on. The markets in Eastern Europe and Asia are the primary hope of survival and even continued existence of these European nations. These nations are not rich nations, they're poor nations, which desperately need technology to enable the poorest part of their population to raise their standard of productivity in the future. This is to speak of 25-year investments, of 10-year investments, and a corresponding amount of credit. Therefore, somebody must create the credit on long-term, credit secured by states and by agreements among states and used according to policies established among states to create a secure line of credit, of public credit, at between 1 and 2% simple interest lending rates over periods of up to a quarter century or generation. Under those conditions, using the lessons we should have learned from the post-war reconstruction in the Americas and Europe in particular, from 1945 to the middle of the 1960s, we could do well. The opportunities in Eurasia are tremendous. The market potential on a 25-year future prospect is tremendous. The building of railroads, of new types of railroads, of transportation systems, of power systems, of transforming an area which contains some of the richest supply of mineral natural resources in the world, in Central and North Asia, into areas which can be productively developed for the benefit of Eurasia as a whole. These are the future markets. This is where the future lies. Only by changing the system, to put the present system into financial bankruptcy, to reestablish the principle of the sovereign nation state, to reestablish the principle of scientific and technological progress, and to create systems of credit and finance, looking a generation ahead, backed by nation-to-nation state agreements, to make this work, and creating mass employment to absorb the mass unemployment growing today in productive ways, to create thus around this the concept of doing this as a new system, and use accounting and use money not as an absolute standard for the economy, but as a tool to assist in the administration and conduct of private relations among entities within the economy. That change in system, that change in thinking about mankind and system is the key to the future. Therefore, we must stop thinking about how to fix a financial system in terms acceptable to that financial system. We must stop thinking about globalization. We must reverse globalization immediately as a price of survival. You don't want to reverse globalization? Then tell me when you intend to die. Because with globalization, you'll die. Nations will die and people within it. It must be reversed back to the nation state. So this, think of the world in terms of systems, long-term systems based on axiomatic qualities and assumptions by peoples and governments, respecting their internal affairs and their relations. Return to a physical standard of performance, the welfare of the individual personality, the future of those personalities' children, the future of that nation in those terms. That is what the best that modern European civilization has produced as a standard. Return to it. And take the freak shows which have dominated the world for more than a century, since 1901, since the assassination of McKinley, and put these things to aside and say, these were mistakes. These ideas were mistakes. We must learn the lessons of history and design now with the governments we have, which are not too good, I admit, with the people we have who are not well educated, with all those other things. We must survive. Our children and grandchildren must survive. Our nations must survive. Put that foremost. Learn the lessons of history, of centuries. The human race has probably been on this planet for 2 million years or more. We know a little bit about prehistoric existence, some crucial things. We have known much about the historical period. Not enough, but much. Learn to think of humanity as something very ancient in its origin. And think of humanity what we hope will be a much longer future than an antiquity. Think in terms of history. Look at what we're doing today as a system from the standpoint of historical criticism. That's what we need to do. All the other criticism doesn't amount to anything because it does not address the problem.
Now we'll move to Lyndon LaRouche's concluding remarks, November 5th in Berlin.
That's the essence of politics. That's the essence of true politics. Don't say we depend upon the consent of the average. The fools of this society, those who say you can't change popular opinion. You can if you use the right method, the method of the sublime. The method is don't accept someone saying something stupid to you. Say, don't you think that's a bit stupid to say? You say you've got to go along with the crowd, but if you go along with the crowd and others go along with the crowd, this country's going to be destroyed and all the people in it. See, the problem here is one more problem I'll conclude with, which is the answer to this thing. How do you personally find the courage to put yourself at total risk for the sake of the principle of the sublime? What if you're going to be killed or tortured? Can you do it? Now, you know, my generation and that generation before were involved in wars. We had to face the reality of dying in war. And that's a very important personal decision. Not that you intend to die in war, but you know you're taking the risk, and it's a fairly enhanced risk. Why should you do it? Why shouldn't you go sit in a foxhole and wait for somebody to drop a merciful hand grenade in on you, as the people of the younger generation would tend to do? Why would you die for humanity? As a sacrifice? Or is it because you would fulfill yourself by being willing to take the risk rather than running from it? How do we get that? If we think that we're connected by ideas, by knowledge, to people from hundreds and thousands of years before us, if we know what they thought, if we know the discoveries they made, if those discoveries live inside us, if we think of what our lives should mean to those who come after us, if we can think ahead to future generations and think that the meaning of our life, which will be short in any case, I mean, 100 years is a very short time in the past 2 million. What comes out of that span of mortal life you live in? What do you get out of it? What happens at the end of it? What does it mean when you're dead? And you count on the fact that what your life means something for the people yet to be born to come after you, for the people, that you, by your life, can take a nation which has been destroyed. And you can, by saving that nation, you can give new meaning to the lives of the people who died before in previous generations. You have a sense of your moral purpose to exist as a mortal human being with a certain quality, the sublime, that partakes the divine. The problem we have, essentially, is a lack of people who have made the step of that kind of personal conviction about the way they should spend their personal lives. A person who is infused with that kind of belief about their personal life will transform the other people around them, will not walk away and say, this is another stupid jerk, but will try to influence the culture around them. You can't necessarily influence everybody, but you can influence a significant number of people if you try. But if you walk away each time, when you should have been, and instead of getting the person to experience the paradox, you walk away, then how many times have you missed the opportunity to awaken the same insight in some other person? How much you might accomplish the miracle of taking a politician who's intelligent, but otherwise seems completely useless morally, and inspiring them to do the kind of deed or show the kind of leadership which might, as a spark, change the situation. See, the problem you face is always a very personal one. People like to say, well, here we are. We are an audience looking at people on the stage. They're not going to listen to us. How could we change the situation? They're on the stage. They're up there. They're important. We can't change their opinion. There's the mob up there, popular opinion. They're the leaders up there. They're powerful. How can we change those people? We just have to sit here in the audience and watch the tragedy unfold. And that's how we destroy ourselves. And the key, I think, in this situation is we're now, is how many people are capable of finding in themselves the moral quality which is characterized by the classics as the sublime. How can you bring yourself to abandon the stupidity that Wallenstein is a tragic figure that caused the problem? If Wallenstein had not been murdered, the war would have ended 16 years earlier. The greatest horror that happened to Germany would never have happened. He was murdered. How can you say that Wallenstein caused the failure? Wallenstein is what he was, and he's portrayed so by Schiller. But the point was that a man who was what he was could at a certain point as a military man with no particular scruple, can say simply on military grounds, this comes to an end. And he was killed for it. And nobody to speak up would support him. And for that, Germany was destroyed. Wallenstein a tragic figure? Or was the society of that period tragic? And was, as the case of the others in the suggests in Wallenstein, was it the lack of two or three more people gifted with the sublime to turn the situation and to bring about the success of the negotiations with Gustav of Adolphus and stop the war right then, instead of the slaughter which occurred for the following 16 years? And the problem is, we touched great art. We touched the great classical art. But we don't see it often enough as politicians, as I do. All great classical art is an essential part of somebody's qualification to become a political figure. Without it, they're not qualified, because they don't lack that sense of the sublime, a practical sense of the sublime, which every politician facing with a major or minor crisis in a career decision has to face.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.